Well, you were here.
When Superior Women first came out, which was about a year ago?
Yes, yes, just about almost exactly a year ago, I think.
Well, what have you been doing over this past year?
Enjoying it. I've traveled a lot, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on another novel and, as always, writing a lot of short stories.
Mm-hmm. So it's been a busy year or it's been
very
a relaxing
busy.
One?
More not relaxing, busy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have the paperback version of Superior Women coming out. At the same time, you have a new collection of short stories called Return Trips. How do you like the cover for Superior Women on the paperback?
Oh, I think it's smashing.
Mm-hmm. When you open it up, it looks almost like a blurb for a television miniseries.
Well, that's true. Of course, pictures never look exactly like the ones in one's own mind, but, you know, it's sort of odd and interesting to see someone else's concept of your book.
Well, the cover of the paperback version, Fawcett Crest, bothered me in some respects because I looked upon Superior Women as a serious novel, and
so did I. God knows.
Yes, of course. You worked hard on it, and there was an obvious effort, and it does have literary quality. But the problem that some of the paperback publishers have, in my opinion, is that they make the jackets gaudy. And they're aiming the book to sell it the largest number of people possible. But I just wonder if it might give the wrong impression about the book.
Well, it doesn't seem to me, I know precisely what you mean, but it doesn't seem to me that that's necessarily bad. I mean, if someone buys it thinking, you know, that it's easy trash, what I hope is that they will then like it for what it is, a serious novel.
For somebody who likes serious novels, might be more comfortable with a cover that is just virtually a blank cover, maybe white with just the title of the book and your name. And
you don't see that. I mean, you don't see that in paperback a lot. And then by way of contrast, there is the jacket of Return Trips in a lot of the same stores at the same instant.
I have a feeling that most writers depend on the paperback sales predominantly. Isn't that where the largest audience comes from for most writers?
I don't know. It's something I've never thought about a lot. I suppose, I mean, as you probably know, this is the first book I've written that sold a lot. I mean, I've never thought in terms of numbers of sales before this book. But I think I was told that paperback sales are usually 10 times hardcover, that's sort of counted on. I found that quite staggering.
Well, it's also staggering when you think, according to a survey that I read in Publishers Weekly, that only 1% of the entire population of the United States will buy a hardcover book in a year.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that frightening?
Think. It must scare me a great deal more than it does you.
No, it doesn't.
And then there are people like our president who never buy books.
Well, they probably has a White House library. He doesn't have to go out and poke around bookstores like I do.
But does he know where it is?
That's a good question. I have a feeling that people are less intimidated by paperback books. I know that in my household, my wife, if I were to bring home a paperback and a hardcover of the same book, she'll automatically reach for the paperback. People seem to be more comfortable with paperbacks. And indeed, I think a hardcover book implies an investment. You're talking about a $16, $17, $18 book. You have a bargain in Return Trips. It's only $14.95.
Yes, I must say I was pleased at that relatively low figure.
But don't you feel that is probably the case, that people sometimes tend to be less intimidated by a paperback?
Well, of course. I mean, Superior Women, I think, is $3.95. It's a lot easier to spend that than $14.95 or than $17.95 or whatever it cost in hardback.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally. I mean, I certainly feel that way.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about dropping the cereal on it that much. I mean,
yeah.
Paperback books are rather disposable.
Yeah, or lending them to those friends who forget to return them.
No, you don't lend your books to anybody, do you?
Yeah, I do. I'm silly in that way. And I don't even keep lists, but I must stop doing that.
You're very optimistic that you'll get the books back.
Well, I'm not optimistic. I'm just foolish.
Yeah. No, I learned a long time ago that I don't loan books anymore. People ask me all the time, hey, you do the book review here on the...
Well, I don't loan books that are signed by friends. I do have that small, helpful rule.
Return trips. When I started reading Return Trips, the first story in there was Alaska, and I began reading, and I said, no, I've read this. As a matter of fact, these books must be reprints of stories that were in other books. And I was baffled. But then as I went on, I saw that the other stories were not familiar to me. Where did I read Alaska before?
Well, it was in Shenandoah. Do you read Shenandoah? Oh, it was also in, or rather, no, it was in last year's O. Henry collection.
I can't remember where I read
Shenandoah is an excellent small magazine, but...
Yeah, no, I did not read that.
Probably not, but you certainly could have read it in last year's O. Henry.
Yeah, all right. I knew I had read it somewhere, and I just could not...
Yeah.
It threw me off a little bit, because I thought I'm reading...
No, I had a hard time with that story. I sent it around everywhere. No one would publish it, so I was very pleased when Shenandoah finally did.
Many of your stories go to the New Yorker, don't they?
Well, I have a contract with them, so they all go there first. Uh-huh. So stories that you read that were not in the New Yorker have been turned down by the New Yorker.
Yeah. On what basis do they make this kind of judgment? Is this purely...
Who, the New Yorker?
Yeah, I mean, the fiction editor there makes a purely arbitrary choice after having a contract with an author and decides
it's not right. It may seem arbitrary to me. It doesn't seem arbitrary to them, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, quite often surprised both by what they do and don't take. I mean, I thought, and I still think, that Alaska is a good story. And then there's another story called Molly's Dog. I don't know if you remember, but in the Times last week, the reviewer Beverly Lowry said that was what she thought was the best story in the collection. And it's certainly a story that I liked very much. Well, no one would publish it. No one. And believe me, it went everywhere, starting at the New Yorker. And I finally sent it to Joyce Carol Oates for her magazine, The Ontario Review, which is where it was published. And that, too, will be in an O. Henry collection. What I'm saying is I don't always understand what's happening at the New Yorker.
Or anyplace else, because
taste is
unpredictable, isn't it?
Well, some magazines you can. I mean, obviously, Alaska, for example, since it's about two cleaning women, would be unlikely to appear in what we call the women's magazines. I mean, I can't imagine that story in Redbook or McCall's. But I really saw no reason why it shouldn't have been in the New Yorker.
Well, I guess the title of your short story collection, Return Trips, is an apt one because you have your settings, well, they go everywhere. There's Yugoslavia. I think Mexico plays a role in a lot of the stories there.
Well, I go to Mexico every year, so it is it's a place I think about.
Mm-hmm. Given a choice, if this is probably an unfair question, but given a choice, you wanted to write short stories for the rest of your life or continue to work with novels, what would it be?
I'm asked that, and I should have come up with a better answer by now. I really don't know. I think I would probably do exactly what I am doing, which is to do both. One of my problems, if you will, in life is that I have an extremely short attention span, so it helps me to have several things in the air, as it were. To go from a novel that I'm working on to a short story.
Do you sometimes work on multiple projects?
Sure.
Two stories simultaneously?
Yes.
Is confusing at all?
Oh, yes, but I'm old enough to be quite used to confusion. I mean, at the moment, I think I have about three stories and one novel going. And you're right, I am confused.
Well, you're traveling to talk about Superior Women right now, and I assume that as you travel around from city to city, you have a notepad or someplace, you keep notes about little things that you see that might ultimately appear in a story?
Yes. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I enjoy about traveling is having breakfast by myself in coffee shops. And the reason that one of the reasons I enjoy that is it's about the only time I can think of, since I don't ever spend time in bars, I get to overhear men talking to each other without women around. It's fascinating. You know what they talk about a lot? Health. I had a wonderful treat just in Seattle. There were two men at the next table. My ear was riveted to their conversation. They were both doctors, and they both just had plastic surgery on their faces. And they were going on about it. They were both rather, you know, okay-looking guys, probably in their mid-40s, but on and on and on about their plastic surgery. So interesting. Anyway, yes, I do take notes on that sort of thing.
Well,
but now that I've told you that, I guess I can't use it.
yes, you will. Well, that's kind of interesting. You say that you've been eavesdropping on men, and one of the things that they seem to talk about is health. But I just wonder, can you stereotype male conversations? Are they really that much different from female conversations?
Well, I don't know. A deprivation that I guess I share with most women is that we don't get to hear many male conversations. I have a close friend whose husband goes skiing often with the man with whom I live, and the woman and I have sometimes speculated about what they talk about when they're off alone skiing, and we've said to each other, do you think they talk about us? And we finally decided, no, they don't. I think we asked them at one point. They said, no, of course not.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder what men talk about. I mean, being a man myself, I'm not sure. It just seems to me that...
Well, what do you talk about when you're off with your men?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't think of any one particular topic that we might talk about.
Well, I guess when they're off skiing, that provides a certain amount of conversation.
Yeah, the service in the restaurant, the machine isn't functioning right. Or,
you don't complain about your wives?
No comment on that. You write, and all of the stories that you've written, you write from a woman's perspective, the lead character is always a woman.
No, excuse me, that isn't true. Sometimes they're men.
Mm-hmm. Mostly women, though.
Yes.
Mostly. 90%, I would say.
Yeah.
Or even above. And yet, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't picture you as a women's writer. I hate to use that phrase, women's writer. That is a writing for a specific market that is aimed at women, because I think that the themes in your stories have enough universality that they would appeal to men and women.
Oh, well, I would certainly hope so. I mean, that's kind and good of you to say, mm-hmm. and I hope that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly don't aim only for women.
Well, are you teaching now?
I'm going to start teaching. I haven't been for a while. I'll be teaching at Berkeley as of this coming January.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the spring term. But I really look forward to that.
Creative writing.
Yes.
You like working with young people?
I do, except my best teaching experience ever was at Stanford, and my best student was a woman in her 70s who you may have read her, wonderful writer named Harriet Doerr.
Oh, yes. She won the National Book Critics Circle.
She won all kinds of stuff, yes. She went on to, yes. But she was absolutely superb, and as I say, she was in her 70s. So I guess what I like is working with excellent writers. But I'm not sure I'm going to find another Harriet.
Somebody was telling me that, they had just been out to Iowa teaching, and the subject of what the young people studying in Iowa came up, who they were reading, and they mentioned... people like Bobby Ann Mason and Raymond Carver and
Jane Ann Phillips.
Jane Ann Phillips and all of these names that were somewhat vague to this. I can't remember who I was talking to, but these authors were somewhat vague because they're relatively new writers through 3-4 years. But that doesn't really surprise me because I have a feeling that it would be more difficult for a young writer, and you could check this out when you go to Berkeley. It might be kind of interesting to see who they are reading. I mean, are they reading Bellow, for example, now?
Offhand, I would guess not.
Well, I would guess not. I would guess they would be reading Bobby Ann Mason. And,
that's right.
And people like
and Raymond Carver. A lot. I've had a lot of... I mean, I admire him very, very much, but his imitators are pretty bad. In my day, generation, a lot of people were imitating Hemingway, who produced an immense amount of really appalling. I mean, I'm speaking of his imitators. What I'm saying is I certainly don't blame Mr. Carver for those who try to emulate him. But I wish they'd go back a little further. I'm sometimes alarmed by students whom I feel haven't read anyone, you know, earlier than Raymond Carver. I always urge them to read Elizabeth Bowen, for heaven's sake, who's such a superb writer, or, you know, somewhat more recently, Cheever,
Elmore Leonard is a writer, writes primarily action thrillers, mystery, but he's really a wonderful writer. If you've ever read any of his stuff. Lives in Detroit. Are you familiar with him at all?
I know who he is, but I haven't read him.
He writes some really interesting...
He's on my list.
it's really... his material goes very fast. But he has a theory that young writers should imitate. He thinks that a young writer should... but not necessarily someone who just wrote Life for the first time last year, but somebody who is good, like a Hemingway, and use that as a form, as a model. Painters do it. Painters imitate other painters. That's where they learn. And what is wrong? There's certainly nothing wrong with using a Hemingway or a Carver as a model, is there?
Some people seem to work out better as models than others. I think was it Gide? Who said that writers really can learn more from other writers of the second rather than the first rank, which is an interesting theory if you think about it. Which is to say, perhaps you're better off imitating Elizabeth Bowen than Dostoevsky.
I mean, which
I would think would be true.
This ranking kind of bothers me in a way. You know, they talk
bothers
about
me a lot.
Writers of the first rank and writers of the second rank, for example.
I know, I retract that because I think it's ludicrous.
Well, but no, it's apt, though. For example, Capote was considered a writer of the second rank who might have been able to make the first rank. You know, I began to think, well, what do they want from the guy? I mean, I realized that he didn't...
yeah.
Perhaps he didn't meet all of his potential, but...
who do?
I mean, they're saying that about Mailer. When are we going to get the big one from Mailer? You know?
Gosh, it seems we've had a lot of big ones from Mailer.
He's a man as a genius. He's
yes.
been turning out novels since 1948, I believe. Naked and the Dead came out, I think, around in there. And,
eight, right.
And which is still considered a masterpiece. And
It seems to me he's written even better books since. But
I'm sure he has. He's 26 years old when he wrote that. 25, all right. Well, close. So,
No, I know what you mean.
This grouping of people, top rank, lower rank, middle rank, all that, I just kind of wonder.
No, it's a game for critics.
Yeah. Well, tell me, Alice Adams, San Francisco, how's it going for you? You still like it as much as you have in the past?
I like it a lot. It works out in a personal way for me extremely well. I don't drive. It's a wonderful city to walk in. I swim. There's a good swimming pool, 15 minutes by foot. And there's not enough going on there to be distracting. There are a few excellent writers who live there whom I see from time to time, and that contact is extremely important to me, but there's not a heavy literary group there.
Did you come in contact with Herb Gold? No? No, you don't? Don't the views distract you? You try to sit there and write, and you look out the window and see...
Well, I work in a fairly
views?
Dark room. When I go for walks, the views are a treat. They're wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they look continuously new. They're often sort of semi, not sunsets, but sort of twilights that have a Japanese washed pencil look.
Well,
I see Evan Cannell, Lenny Michaels. I see a lot of Diane Johnson. Sheila Valentine's a marvelous writer who lives there.
Is that how you pronounce his name, Cannell?
Cannell. Evan Cannell.
Diane Johnson, she was here a while back when she was promoting her book on...
Hammett.
And
she's a very good friend. I see her a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell her hello for me.
Okay.
And I'm looking...
I think you said that the last time we saw each other.
And you didn't say hello, did
I
you?
Did.
You
I did. I did. Believe me. Truly.
Well, I'd like to get her back when she has something new out. I think she did have a book of essays out
That's right.
A year or so ago. I can't remember the title. But I don't think she did.
Novelists and Terrorists?
Yes, that was it. Something with terrorists in it.
Terrorists and Novelists.
Yeah, but I don't think she did any promotion on it, or at least I don't.
Well, with a book of essays, publishers wouldn't probably send you around.
Well, they sent William Gass around.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and his book of essays was so obscure to many people. I mean, I thought they were wonderful, and
he's wonderful.
A delightful man to
isn't
talk
he?
To.
Isn't he? Yes.
You read these word games, And that's what he's playing. He plays these marvelous word games, games that he plays. And I'm sure that most people reading these essays would be baffled. But they're almost like novels. It's almost like fiction. He calls them essays, but I mean they don't make sense really, but except in a very labored way. But they're really clever.
Well, he has an extraordinary mind, certainly. He was on an NEA panel, which is where I was, so I know him very slightly.
A lot of bookstores in San Francisco, aren't there?
Yes, there are.
Do you prowl the bookstores?
Well, I go to a special one called the Green Apple, which is out, again, it's on my beat. I can walk there in about 16 minutes.
What sort of books do you poke around for?
I'm pretty eclectic. But they have a very, very good stock. You can't smoke in the store, which I appreciate. Mm-hmm. And I like them.
Is this a used bookstore?
Both. I mean, they have a good used and new department.
There's a wonderful used bookstore here in New York, if you're familiar with it, called The Strand.
Yes, I know about The Strand.
Huge, huge store. It's on three stories.
Well, the Green Apple is one of those nice places that, I get sent a lot of books, so I can give them books that I don't want and get credit toward others that I do.
Well, Alice Adams, I appreciate your stopping in. I know you're going to be heading out to the airport while you came with your bag.
Oh, no, I'm moving into CBS.
Well, we've got plenty of room. We've had a lot of cutbacks, so we've got a lot of empty space for you. And it's nice that you came back to fill me in on what you've been doing and to talk about the paperback version of Superior Women. I'm delighted that you have a hardcover book of short stories out again.
Well, the coincidence of they're both coming out at the same time was extremely nice for me.
Yes, that's right. And I'll get you back when you have another book.
I hope so, too. In any case, it's fun to see you again.
Nice seeing you again.